Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Power Hungry Podcast. I'm Robert Bryce. On this podcast, we talk about energy, power, innovation, and politics. And we're going to talk a lot of power and politics today with my guest, Michelle Bloodworth. She is the president and CEO of America's Power, which represents the coal-fired generators in America. Michelle, welcome to the Power Hungry Podcast.
Well, thank you, Robert. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here. I've followed your work for years, and I can't think of a better place to talk about certainly energy and the energy sector, and certainly a lot of the challenges that we're facing on Power Hungry Podcast today.
Great. Well, now I mentioned America's Power, and you're a trade association. I think you've changed your name in some recent years, but you are the president and CEO there. Your trade association represents the companies that, as I understand, supply and operate America's coal-fired power plants. But that's a brief introduction. Guests on this podcast introduce themselves. So now imagine you've arrived somewhere, you don't know anyone, you have 60 seconds to tell them who you are. Please introduce yourself.
All right. Well, America's Power, as Robert said, is the only national trade association who advocates on behalf of coal electricity, both at the federal and the state level. Our members consist of electricity generators, coal producers, transportation companies, and equipment manufacturers who are involved in some part of the coal supply chain. I always like to tell people that certainly America's Power supports all energy resources which provide affordable and reliable energy, because as most people know, all energy resources complement each other in different ways and in different times. I certainly do strongly believe that the coal fleet has been one of the foundations of the electricity grid, and certainly we need all resources. We don't need to eliminate any resources, and I do think that coal, because of the fact that it provides reliable, resilient, and affordable electricity, will not only be needed now, but also in the foreseeable future.
Okay, good. And just so we're clear, you're based in Arlington, Virginia, is that correct?
I am, yes.
Okay, gotcha. And how long have you been in your job?
So I've been in my job about 6.5 years. And prior to that, I worked for MISO, which is the Midwest Grid Operator. And then I also spent 2 decades of my career in the natural gas industry, both on the pipeline, the producer side, and the LDC side.
Gotcha. Okay. So long history in the energy sector, including at MISO, Midcontinent Independent System Operator. Okay. So good. Well, I looked up America's Power. I like to do my homework. I looked at your Form 990. Your revenues are about $3 million. Now, for comparison, $3 million in 2022. For comparison, the American Clean Power Association, which represents the solar and wind crowd and their batteries and the rest of them, had revenue of $51 million. And I'm just a little preface for my question here, because, you know, I've got to be very blunt here, and I'm not going to tell you something you don't know. America's coal-fired fleet is getting killed. I mean, just very definitely. In 2008, the EIA's numbers, 2008 coal-fired generation in the U.S., since 2008, it's fallen by more than half. In 2008, about 2,000 terawatt hours per year were coming from coal-fired generation. In 2022, it was about 800 terawatt hours. Is there a war on coal in America?
Well, there's certainly been a war on coal as it relates to this administration. Certainly no secrets. I wouldn't say it's just coal. I think there certainly are a lot of policies coming forward that really want to see the retirement of both natural gas and coal. I would also say that I'm cautiously optimistic. Certainly, we've spent a long time over the past, I would say, 3 or 4 years really expressing our concern over the accelerated rate of the retirement of coal plants. It's not just America's Power now. You know, you're hearing from the North American Electric Reliability Council, Jim Robb. We spend a lot of time with him, their CEO, all the electricity experts, who that's what they do every day, is try to keep our lights on, from these grid operators who are all expressing loud alarms about the rapid pace of the loss of dispatchable resources and how the grid is certainly not ready to replace those with the same capacity value and also the same reliability attributes that coal provides.
Sure. Well, let's Well, I want to just ask that again, because I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. So is there a war on coal?
Yes, I certainly think that there are a lot of people who are opposed to coal. However, I do think, I do believe that when people really understand the need to put reliability first, we've done a lot of polling. People become very supportive of coal and of thermal resources because of those attributes that we don't have technology, whether that's long duration battery storage, whether that's hydrogen. I certainly support carbon capture, but those technologies are decades away, and they're certainly not widely deployable on a commercial basis.
Sure.
And so I do see the conversation changing.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to talk about FERC and NERC and the warnings that they've made, and the RTOs as well have warned about this in very clear terms. But who's waging the war? From where is the, I mean, what is, who's waging the war and what's the ideology behind it?
Yeah, I think because electricity is so complex, certainly the NGO community is supporting this administration's goal to completely decarbonize the electricity sector by 2035. Certainly from an engineering and a physics and a realistic standpoint, that is not realistic and not achievable, as we certainly are seeing. There are many challenges to the grid transition, which I can talk about those in a minute. But our biggest challenges are six environmental regulations, and certainly half of those were promulgated in less than 3 months. Just even trying to assess the impact, you know, the implications of these regulations. Certainly the most onerous one is the carbon rule, which many call Clean Power Plan 2.0, which really would put the entire coal fleet at risk by 2030, when all these electricity grid operators and NERC are saying, you know, 3/4 of the country is at elevated or high risk of blackouts.
Right.
I mean, that is unheard of with a country who certainly can be energy independent.
Well, let's talk about the grid for just a minute, because I think you're exactly right when you say it's incredibly complex, and it is. And we take electricity for granted in the United States. And as you, I'm sure you know, I've written about electricity a little bit and am pretty familiar with the business. But it is an insanely complicated grid that we have in the United States. Over 3,000 electricity providers. You got the RTOs, you got the PUCs at the state level. You have all these NGOs, you have the investor-owned utilities, you have the publicly owned utilities, you have the co-ops, you have the federal entities. That's the preface for this question, which is this a simple one, but it goes and underscores all the things you're talking about. Who is responsible for the reliability of the electric grid in America?
And I think you point out a great problem, because there's not one entity who is, you know, accepts that they're fully responsible for the reliability of the grid. And so the challenge is that certainly it's going to take states, legislation and policy decisions that they're making about the timelines of decarbonization. We are seeing state utility commissioners also sound large alarms. I haven't seen, at least in my career, publicly, a state utility commission, South Dakota commissioners a couple weeks ago, basically sent a letter, public letter, to the utility that they regulate in South Dakota because of three large coal plants totaling about 2,000 megawatts that they plan to retire in Minnesota. The Minnesota State Utility Commission approved those retirements, and South Dakota is basically saying, you know, we're going to have blackouts. We're listening to MISO. We've looked at their analysis. MISO's showing they're going to have a gap next year. That gap grows through 2040. Again, even when they look at all of the renewables that are in the queue, but their ability to connect those, certainly we have a tremendous amount of transmission. You know, according to the Electric Power Research Institute, if we're going to be able to replace and decarbonize the entire electricity grid by 2035, then we're going to have to add 1 million megawatts of wind, solar, and some battery storage. Certainly that has a price tag of about $1 trillion. We all know how hard it is to get transmission built. Certainly there is transmission that is needed, but that typically takes 15 to 17 years. We have inadequate natural gas infrastructure. Certainly, we've seen a lot of that during these extreme winter events.
Right.
It's certainly hard to get any of that permitted. And then I also talk about technology. You know, we don't have the technology to be able to replace fossil fuels. And then all while we're trying to electrify the economy, we are seeing more electricity demand growth. Utilities are increasing their forecasts. Just from even a year ago, we've seen that in Georgia. We've seen that in Kansas. PJM has tripled their electricity demand forecast, which is why we're seeing the need to delay many of these coal plant retirements and now even natural gas as well.
Sure. So I want to make sure I'm saying, hearing what you're saying, because I'm familiar with the issues you're talking about, but is there any, who owns the reliability issue? I mean, I preface that my friend Meredith Angwin, I was speaking with her this morning. She wrote the fabulous book, Shorting the Grid. We've talked about these ideas about deregulation, restructured markets, et cetera. And she said, people will challenge her and say, well, you're in favor of monopolies, the vertically old, vertically integrated utilities. And her reply is, I'm not in favor of monopolies. I'm in favor of accountability. So who is responsible for reliability of the electric grid in America? Or is it because this is ultimately what we're talking about, isn't it? Where does the buck stop when it comes to reliability?
And again, if you look in MISO, MISO would tell you it's a shared responsibility between state utility commissioners.
If it's a shared responsibility, then everybody can point to everyone else, right? That's the problem.
And that's the problem, because even NERC, you know, NERC can, and they do a nice job. Jim Robb's been all over the United States.
Right.
You know, they can do reports. They can issue warnings. You know, they can set standards, but they cannot force a utility not to retire a dispatchable unit, even when they think that 3/4 of the country is elevated or high risk of electricity shortages.
Right.
And so that's why, in our opinion, it's going to take changes at the state level from the way state utility commissioners look at analysis, do reliability analysis. It's going to take federal legislation. Certainly that would require federal agencies, including the EPA, to do reliability analysis before they finalize any rules.
Right.
I've never seen the grid operators who now are engaging and providing very strong comments and trying to work with the EPA to really educate them on their concerns, whether that's the ozone transport rule, whether that's the carbon rule, you know, to basically say, if you finalize these rules in the way that you've proposed them, we're not going to be able to keep the lights on.
Well, I think that's where we're getting to the nut here, I think. And I'm being insistent on this idea of reliability, because this fundamentally is what we're talking about. And I'm 100% with you in terms of affordability, reliability, resilience. You filed comments with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last June, and you quoted very right near the top of your comments, you quoted James Robb, the president and CEO of North American Electric Reliability Corporation. He said, unless reliability and resilience are appropriately prioritized, this is Robb, current trends indicate the potential for more frequent and more serious long-duration reliability disruptions, including the possibility of national consequence events. I mean, these are very strong terms, very strong. Well, they could be stronger. And I think James Danley last year before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, his colleague Mark Christie, the chairman of the commission, Willie Phillips, all warned about potential for catastrophic blackouts in the United States. But I'm going to read back to you, Michelle, what you've said is that because it's this shared responsibility at the state level, the RTOs, the feds, actually getting this... I'll put it this way. Are we pounding the table hard enough? And I use the collective we. Are you pounding the table hard enough? Are the people who are on the side of the business side pounding the table hard enough? Because I just gave you the numbers. Your size of your organization, all due respect, you're a fraction of the size and have, let's face it, coal is not fashionable. I don't think I'm shocking you to say that. Where wind and solar have budgets 13x the size of your organization. They have the media behind them. They have a whole lot of public, you know, acceptance and love that the coal industry doesn't have. You're facing a serious uphill battle here, aren't you? Maybe I'm just saying Mr. Captain Obvious here, but the coal fleet in the U.S. is being decimated.
I don't disagree with you that we're certainly facing an uphill battle, and certainly America's Power is pounding the street as hard as we can. And I think we've done that in an effective way, certainly with more resources. All organizations could do more. I think what has changed, though, is, you know, even when Senator Manchin held Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, you know, last year, and he had all of the four FERC commissioners. And when he asked them, is coal, you know, still going to be needed in order right. to maintain reliability? And the fact that every single one of them, whether they're Republican, independent, or a Democrat, said yes.
Yeah.
We still need coal for the foreseeable future. And so to me, the conversation now is people accept that there's a problem. I think where you would organizations differ and resources differ is on what is the solution now to solve the problem.
Right.
But to me, until people admitted that there is a problem with the pace and the premature retirement of all of these resources, that it's hard to bring forward the solutions and to convince people that this is an urgent problem. You know, when I think about, and obviously we track coal retirements very closely. So in 2012, the coal fleet stood at about 317,000 megawatts. Fast forward today, it's about 180,000 megawatts. So over 40% of the coal fleet has retired. But what's more concerning is in the next 5 years, a third of the coal fleet remaining has publicly announced retirement. On top of that, we're also seeing, you know, natural gas generation retire as well. And what a lot of people felt like is because obviously when grid operators look at how dependable a resource is, one of the reasons why we need a coal fleet and why we need thermal resources is because coal provides a capacity value, which is a measure of dependability on those days of extreme weather when you really have a spike in electricity demand.
Right.
When you look at solar only is given a capacity value of about 13%. So that means coal is about 6.6 more dependable than solar, and it's about 3.4 more dependable than wind. And so not only do you have to triple or add six times as many megawatts of those other resources, now NERC and all the PJM, ISO, all the grid operators have identified reliability attributes that we've taken for granted. MISO's identified six, you know, fuel assurance, long duration energy, energy that we have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, voltage stability. And that's when you get into a lot of the complexities of the electricity grid.
Right.
But there aren't any other resources. And certainly coal, you know, it's hard to beat 90 days of stockpile of on-site coal, especially when you look at the challenges during a lot of these winter storms that natural gas faced, because natural gas is used for a lot of other things. And every coal plant that is retired obviously is putting that reliability and that fuel security greater at risk. And that's why we're saying we need to avoid the premature retirement of these coal plants that have a lot more life. And we need this administration and the EPA obviously, to look at all the impact of these six environmental regulations, many of them which we think need to be revised and withdrawn, including the carbon rule.
Right. So you said that by 2030, the EPA, well, you mentioned 2012, the U.S. had 317 gigawatts. I think you said megawatts, but anyway, 317,000 megawatts of installed coal capacity. 2023, you said it was 180 gigawatts, but by 2030, the EPA is projecting that it could be as low as 46 gigawatts. I mean, that's a quarter of the current size, roughly. And would that be because of the carbon rule that you mentioned?
So, in looking at the carbon rule,
obviously, and just to be clear, if people don't understand this, so this was a proposed rule that was issued last May by the Environmental Protection Agency that would affect nearly all of the coal-fired power plants in America and all of the coal plants and most of the gas plants, ultimately affecting something like 90% of all the coal and gas-fired generation in America. It's a draconian approach that would require massive decreases in CO2 emissions from that fleet, include, and the solutions that they propose are carbon capture and sequestration and hydrogen. Have I summarized that pretty well, Michelle? You know these regs better than I do, but that's how I would read it back.
Yes. So according to EPA's own analysis on the impact of the carbon rule, they are basically projecting by 2030, we'd have a 17% decline, meaning retirement of coal generation. And they're virtually showing in 2035, we would have virtually no coal.
And I'm sorry, and the projection of, and this is the EPA saying this?
This is the EPA's own projection and own analysis. And so when I testified at the recent FERC conference on the carbon rule, you know, both Commissioner Danley and others and Commissioner Christie said, well, that certainly doesn't sound like an orderly retirement. You know, Jim Robb keeps saying we cannot have a disorderly retirement of this generation until we have technology, we have steel in the ground. It has whatever's replacing it has the same capacity value and it has the same reliability attributes. And obviously, we're all seeing the challenges as it relates to permitting, transmission, and technology. The other certainly flaw is, because to me, the Clean Power Plan 2.0 is significantly worse than the Clean Power Plan 1.0. And so this carbon rule, which requires obviously the coal fleet to meet certain amounts of carbon reduction, just if you just look at the timelines, so EPA is going to do everything they can to finalize this rule in probably April of this year, because they want to make sure that a new administration could not use the Congressional Review Act to roll that regulation back.
Right.
All right. States have 2 years in order to comply and put together state implementation plans, which EPA can decide to approve or disapprove. So since this regulation requires, if you want to operate your coal plant, we have many owners who have put a lot of money into their coal plants. They have a lot more years of life. If you want to operate it beyond 2040, then you have to install carbon capture and achieve 90% carbon reduction in less than 3 years. I have five members who have been pursuing some of those for the past 9 or 10 years who also say it is not physically and feasibly possible for us to have all of the infrastructure. You know, not every coal plant even has the geography or the physical capability of installing carbon capture.
Right. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying, that under the proposed rule now, which EPA has fast-tracked, and I know they reopened some part of it for some additional comment, but you're saying that to comply with the rule as written now, all of the coal-fired power plants in the United States would have to, by within the next 3 years, implement carbon capture systems and have them in place?
Well, they would have to have them in place by 2030. But no one is
by 2030. So 6 years, we'll call it five
right.
years.
No one is going to start construction until your state, the EPA, approves your state implementation plan. You're not going to spend $1.5 billion. And so
I see. Okay. So even so under the timeline, the state, say I'm in Texas, they would have to supply. They would have to have their SIP, their SIP, approved by EPA, which would take 2 years. That would give, so that takes 2 years away from the five, let's call it. Then that gets approved. Then they would only have 3 years to install
Correct.
This massive amount of infrastructure, including equipment that would have a parasitic load of 25% to 35% on their power plants. Then have a way to inject all of the CO2 that they're collecting somewhere underground, somewhere somehow, at massive cost. Otherwise, they shut down.
Correct. I mean, many states don't
did
even
I get
have
that simple little thing. Did I get this all pretty
simple? And then on top of that, you know, if you agree, because obviously it's got forced mandate retirement dates. And so if you agree, you know, the incentive is if you agree to retire earlier, then EPA is either going to require you, if you're a coal plant, to co-fire with 40% natural gas. Many of these coal plants are not near natural gas pipelines. We already have a very taxed natural gas system. And if your coal plant has to burn 40% natural gas, the economics are probably going to cause you to retire it anyway, or you have to reduce your capacity factor to 20%.
Right. That was the other part of the equation here, is how the capacity factor figures into how this carbon rule is applied.
Correct.
But is it fair to say it's a, well, the other part of this that just sticks in my craw, and now I'm going to opine a little bit or add a little editorial here, is this is coming out of the administrative state. Again, this isn't Congress passing this. So back up for just a minute. I don't know if you're a lawyer or what your background is, but the Chevron doctrine is now pending before the Supreme Court. I thought some of this was resolved in the West Virginia versus EPA case, but now this is a big issue in front of the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court rules that the administrative state broadly, right, the issue is the administrative state, how much is Congress ceding their power to the bureaucracy? It could, if the Supreme Court comes out with a strong ruling on the Chevron doctrine, could this neuter or slow down or stop the EPA's actions on these things, then where the industry could just say, well, Chevron doctrine, you know, meet to see in court? How might that affect this? I know that's a lot of conjecture to be made here, but this is all about the administrative state's power to impose these incredibly costly mandates on all parts of the economy, but particularly in this case, the electric sector. How do you see it?
Well, I'm not an attorney. I'm an engineer. But there are attorneys who certainly think that there are many legal flaws in the carbon rule. One of those is certainly in the Chevron doctrine, which is the major questions doctrine. And also where, you know, this rule is really causing fuel switching, obviously in the West Virginia versus EPA. The Supreme Court very loudly said that is not acceptable. You know, most of these rules, unfortunately, unless the EPA provides more flexibility, they're going to end up in the courts. Certainly the ozone transport rule, which right now affects 28 states. EPA recently added five more. It also, NERC highlighted that single rule, basically saying that the ozone transport rule, the way that it was proposed, is a reliability risk. They also highlighted in their recent long-term reliability assessment, the first time I've seen, that federal policies are heightening the risk,
right?
Because they're not flexible. There's no off-ramps. There's no tools to make sure that if we need those resources, that we can keep them on. As it relates to the ozone transport rule, affecting those 28 states, that rule alone would cause the retirement of a third of the coal fleet. That rule right now is in litigation. There have been 12 federal circuit courts, some of those liberal courts, who have granted motions to stay when EPA basically FIPped and disapproved their state implementation plans. On February the 21st, industry, we are one of the litigants, one of the parties. The Supreme Court, which is pretty unusual, I think it's only happened one other time because of the cost and because of the reliability implications, has agreed to consider a motion to stay on the ozone transport rule. So we will be finding out fairly soon.
You said you're an engineer. What kind of engineer are you?
So I'm a mechanical engineer, and ironically, my first job out of college, War Eagle, I went to Auburn, was designing a coal-fired power plant for Alabama Power. It was Miller Steam Plant.
Uh-huh. So I know more women are getting into engineering now, and you are an Auburn grad. How many of, in your engineering class, in mechanical engineering, how many women were there?
Oh, there was probably less than 10%. Uh-huh. I would say now that number is probably like 40%.
Right.
There are a lot of women who are going into the engineering fields.
Right. Well, in the utility sector, I guess, in the energy sector as a whole, right, far more, you know, it's a bunch of old white dudes, right, you know, generally speaking. But I am seeing more women, particularly young women, coming into the industry. But how does that make you, I guess, we talk about this a lot. I've talked about it a lot in my presentations about policy, and that the policy that's being promulgated that affects the energy and power sectors is being made by lawyers and not by engineers. And I've had in my head for a long time an essay about the two cultures, right? And C.P. Snow wrote about this in 1950 about the humanities versus the sciences. But I see it as in policy as the legal bureaucrats against the engineers. Is it simple enough to think about this policy divide, this view of the grid, this view of the future as one where you have a lot of non-technical people making rules that involve a very technical business, but they don't know what the hell they're talking about? I mean, I'm asking you this as an engineer. How do you see it? The culture here, let's put aside all these things we've talked about. There's the dollars, there's this, there's that, but as a cultural issue, as a trained engineer, as a woman who's an engineer, how do you see the cultural breakdown here? Should it be part of the broader discussion?
No, it absolutely should. And let me give you a good example.
Sure.
So, you know, we found that there's been little coordination between the EPA and the grid operators, who certainly are electricity experts. Got tons of engineers. I work for one, and that's what they do every day. And to have the electricity grid operators, because EPA is not an expert on certainly electric reliability.
Right.
And, you know, we certainly brought up in our comments, so did the grid operators, that there was not proper reliability analysis done. So basically, when EPA looked at resource adequacy, do we have enough capacity based on the impact that this rule is going to have on the retirement of other resources? Their model will never show a shortfall. So it just assumes we'll have enough transmission, whether that's nuclear is going to replace it, whatever is economic, you know, whatever megawatt of coal goes away, then we're going to assume that it's going to be replaced.
Right.
But they never looked at operations reliability. You know, what happens during periods of extreme weather? Are we losing critical reliability attributes, voltage stability, inertia, all those things that are complicated and some people don't really understand? And so what we in our comments and certainly have told the EPA is that they need to work with these electricity grid operators before they finalize and promulgate their rules, because the electricity grid operators, in their comments on the carbon rule, you know, they brought up five different areas: no proper reliability analysis, we're losing reliability attributes, issues with resource adequacy, technology that has not been commercially demonstrated. We don't have one coal plant in the United States that can achieve 90% carbon capture, but right. yet they're saying that's widely demonstrated. And also that, you know, they also encouraged, as it relates to technology, they basically in their comments said hope is not a good strategy. You know, same thing what we've been telling FERC is that they also need to be certainly working, even though they're not the environmental regulator. Obviously, they are responsible for the reliability of the bulk power system.
Right.
And there's lots of things that they can do as well. And I certainly, you know, was appreciative of Chairman Phillips holding that conference. I think they need to hold more.
Right.
As it relates to these environmental regulations.
But isn't it so? I agree with it's interesting how, you know, that your response, because I think, you know, there's the cultural difference, right? But it's the policymakers dictating policy to the operators, right? Without really understanding what the operators are doing or how things work. I want to talk about inertia, but the broader point, it seems to me, I talk to a lot of rural cooperatives. I'm happy to travel to rural America. This is part of my job and one that I really enjoy. You know, I've been to Kearney, Nebraska. I've been to Bismarck. I've been, you know, I go to these small, you know, municipalities and talk to local people about what's going on. But it seems to me the broader impact or the bigger danger of this skein of rules, whether it's the ozone transport rule or the greenhouse gas rule or what have you, is that it creates uncertainty for the utility sector, right? And that there's no ability, because these are long-lived assets that are incredibly expensive, that the cooperatives, the generation transmission out guys, the, you know, the local you know, energy, the public power entities in small towns across Kansas, they don't know where to put their money, because there's so much uncertainty on the technical and legal side. Is that contributing to the problem, or how do you see that uncertainty playing out in terms of the investment side?
Yeah, certainly the policies coming from this administration are creating tons of financial uncertainty. I agree with you. A lot of our members are public power and co-ops who serve rural America.
Right.
These assets are long lived. We have members who have coal plants who are 65 years old. They've put a lot more money in them, new steam turbines. And it's very difficult for them because they're looking at, okay, let's say I'm going to comply with the ozone transport rule and I'm going to put in an SCR or scrubber.
SDR, forgive me, what?
Selective catalytic reduction.
SCR, okay.
SCR.
Thank you.
And that may require an investment if that plant does not already have SCR of about $150 million. And they may decide, I'm going to go ahead and make that investment.
Right. But
then they're over there looking in 2030 at the carbon rule, that if it's not overturned in the courts, which we suspect it will be, then they may decide to go ahead and retire that unit earlier, which is not incorporated into many of the projections by EPA.
Right.
And it certainly is very difficult for them to make a decision, even if you're thinking, okay, I'm going to build a new combined cycle plant. But then I'm looking at the carbon rule and I'm thinking, well, look how expensive hydrogen is. It's not even commercially viable right now. You know, I don't have all the infrastructure in place. And so what we are seeing, though, is, you know, we've seen about 13 states who have rollback and delayed retirements, about 13,000 megawatts. A lot of those are in the Midwest because of these warnings by MISO, by the Southwest Power Pool. You know, I think one of the best examples, and certainly I live in Virginia, is when you look at certainly demand center, AI, electricity demand growth. And so you've got a grid operator, PJM, who basically, you know, sent a letter to Talen, which owns a large coal plant in Maryland. Well, because the state put so much pressure on the closure of that plant, it's one of the largest coal plants in Maryland and even in PJM. It serves the Baltimore area, growing demand area.
And I'm glad you brought this up. It's called Brandon Shores. It's in Maryland, and PJM warned about the closure of this plant because of reliability and then specifically grid voltage, if I'm remembering correctly. And we talked about that, inertia. But I'm interrupting, yes. But I just wanted to make sure people understand which one we're talking about.
So PJM, basically, you know, Talen, when a unit wants to deactivate, when they want to retire their unit, you know, they submit a request to PJM and PJM does analysis. And just like you said, PJM found like 600 reliability violations, a lot of those related to voltage stability, and basically said, you know, Talen, we need you to enter into a reliability must run, a contract that would guarantee their return and return on investment, and certainly their operating and fixed costs. But Talen has, and they said, we need, you know, we can't refigure the grid to add additional transmission. It's probably going to take us until 2028, and it's going to have a price tag of close to $1 billion.
To replace that generation capacity, and Brandon Shores, I just looked it up, 1,370 megawatts coal-fired power. It's owned by Talen Energy, T-A-L-E-N, based out of Houston, I believe is the background on that, right?
It is.
But Talen was motivated to close it because here's the key part, right? By litigation that was filed by the Sierra Club, right? This was a deal that Talen cut with the Sierra Club. I'm a longtime critic of the Sierra Club. I don't like them. I'm sure they don't like me back. But this was some deal that they cut because Sierra Club was suing them. So they said, well, we're going to announce it. But now PJM, the regional transmission operator, saying, you shouldn't close that plant. But does PJM have the authority to prevent them from closing?
They do not. And so that
reliability, the buck doesn't stop anywhere. No one owns the reliability chore.
No. So Talen is, basically Talen is saying, okay, unless the Sierra Club lets me out of this environmental liability, and unless the state is more flexible on my air permit, you know, I want to enter into a reliability must run, but no, I'm not going to do it. PJM has asked the Sierra Club basically to negotiate, work with Talen and the state to ensure that they don't have rolling blackouts because they don't have any power or transmission necessary.
And what is the Sierra Club saying?
Right now, they're not letting them out of the agreement. And so it's unclear what's going to happen.
This
I mean,
is
I know
just insane. I didn't know about the Sierra Club part of this, but somehow that they have so much power in this negotiation that they can effectively force this closure of a power plant this large, this important, this critical to reliability.
Right.
But they don't have to deliver any power. They don't have to deliver any molecules, right? They just can, they can sue them until the cows come home. There's no, well, this is, I'm getting a little hot under the collar. I may come over there and join your outfit, but never.
and PJM is telling the Sierra Club, please work it out. You know,
right.
we don't have any other, you know, alternative. And it's not just, Talen owns another plant called Wagner. They've just gotten another letter from PJM. It's also coal and oil plants telling them that we also need those plants until 2028. And it's the same situation. So right now there's no definitive answer, and no PJM, you know, they can ask somebody, but they can't force anybody. So if they
ask nicely, maybe they'll get their way, right? Or say, we'll give you cookies at the end of the day. A quick station break. My guest is Michelle Bloodworth, and we're talking about the crisis in reliability, which is not my line. It is what James Danley, former FERC Commissioner James Danley, has testified to. Michelle is the president and CEO of America's Power, which is a trade association that represents the companies that supply fuel to and operate coal-fired power plants in America. You can find more at americaspower.org. Did I get that commercial right there, Michelle? Is that good enough? So this Brandon Shores was an issue that I think was when I had down here to talk about. But this seems to me to be one of the most clearest examples, most lucid examples of what is happening and how there's no broader consideration at either the regional level or the national level of the importance of thermal generation in the power fleet in America. Who besides the Sierra Club, who do you identify as the entities that are pushing this agenda? Who are the ones, if you were going to tell me who the key obstacles or the key foes are that are facing the reliability, the problems, from where are they coming besides examples like this with the Sierra Club?
Well, certainly, it's no secret that the NGOs are certainly very supportive. You certainly seen Gina McCarthy, who worked for the NRDC, who's very supportive of these, you know, overly aggressive decarbonization goals to basically eliminate, you know, in my opinion, all fossil fuels. You know, when you talked about, obviously, the American Clean Power Association, certainly the NRDC and the Sierra Club's revenues are over $350 million. Doesn't mean all those monies are going to obviously oppose and attack coal plants. But certainly some of it is. You've got the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, certainly, which was not putting, in my opinion, reliability first. And again, I'm not opposed to wind and solar. We need them all, given that we're trying to electrify and grow this economy. Now you've got Michael Bloomberg, you know, and his $500 million campaign Beyond Carbon, which is also focused on natural gas. Certainly, it's not my prerogative to tell Michael Bloomberg, you know, whether or not he can spend his $500 million. But when you look at the Inflation Reduction Act, which certainly has a tremendous amount of incentives for wind and solar, putting wind and solar on steroids before these electricity grids can really handle that amount. That $369 billion, that's being paid by the taxpayers.
Right.
And so in my opinion, there needs to be a lot more education and people who support an all-of-the-above, genuine all-of-the-above energy strategy.
Which states, if just give me the scenario here. I mentioned I was in Bismarck, North Dakota a couple of weeks ago. Glad to be there. I apparently missed the really cold weather, but it was cold enough when I was there. 55% of the electricity in North Dakota is generated from coal. Most of that is lignite. Which states are the most reliant on coal? Give me the scenario how this plays out if the carbon rule from the EPA goes forward, that Beyond Carbon campaign, that they get their way, and Michael Bloomberg has said he wants to shut every coal plant in America down. Which states are the burden here is not evenly distributed geographically. Which states are going to be hurt the most if this war on coal is successful?
So certainly, you know, West Virginia, Kentucky, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Missouri, Utah, Wyoming, there's over 20 states who receive more than 20% of their electricity generation comes from coal, but 41 states use some type of electricity generated from coal. But there
I'm sorry, 20 states get 20% or more of their power from coal.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think so certainly some states will be hit more. Obviously, you've seen a lot of attorney generals. That's why as it relates to those on transport rule, the carbon rule are getting involved in litigation. It's going to drive up electricity prices. It certainly will affect economic development within their states. For those states that certainly rely heavily upon coal. We are seeing, though, some states, back to, you know, solutions. Kentucky passed some legislation called SB4 that would require before any coal plant could be retired that proper reliability analysis needs to be done. Replacement capacity needs to be still in the ground. We are seeing, though, although these wholesale markets are very complex, we are seeing wholesale electricity grid operators bring forward market reforms. To me, that would send signals to delay the retirement of coal. Some of it is to send signals to build new thermal generation, but those same price signals, because, you know, the analysis that both PJM and MISO have done that house the largest majority of the coal fleet are both showing capacity shortfalls. MISO next year, PJM's recent analysis has showed 2027. And so to me, it's going to take a combination of federal legislation. We certainly are supporting Senator Barrasso's got a SPUR Act permitting reform that has two components of it that would require that EPA does proper reliability analysis before they can promulgate these rules. They work with the electricity grid operators. Another component would require that FERC to make sure that within a year, these different reliability attributes that we're losing at a pretty fast pace are properly valued, which certainly will send better price signals for those generators to be able to make the necessary investments. And then certainly we think that the EPA should withdraw and start over as it relates to the greenhouse gas rule, or we're certainly going to be putting ourselves straight into a reliability crisis, stifling investment. A lot of people aren't going to want to make investment in their coal, natural gas plants, obviously with the uncertainty of that rule.
Right. I was impressed. I think it was PJM, MISO, ERCOT, and SPP all sending joint comments, a joint letter to the EPA saying, you need to start over again. I'm paraphrasing here, but that's the way I read it. National Rural Electric Cooperative Association filed very strong comments as well. But it's not only, so you mentioned the greenhouse gas rule, the carbon rule, you mentioned the ozone transport rule, but there are other issues. And so if I was going to look, here's my view, and I'm, you know, put my cards on the table. I've never been ashamed or bashful about expressing my opinion. I think we need to keep all of our coal plants open in America, right? Until we can clearly show that we don't, you know, that the reliability problem is going away, keep all of them open, right? So first quick question, if say we have, I doubt Joe Biden, if he's reelected, would do this, but maybe it's possible. But the new president, whoever it is in early 2025, could they issue an executive rule, an executive order saying we are facing a reliability crisis, all coal plants in America must stay open until I decide otherwise or until we show some other reason that they can be closed? Is there, could the president act unilaterally in that case? I mean, there'd be litigation, of course, but could they do, whether Trump is in jail or not? I mean, we don't know who a Republican, it would be likely be a Republican that would be so inclined to do this. Could that happen? Would it make a difference?
Yes, I think it certainly would make a difference, certainly whether that's an executive order or changes to the Federal Power Act. There are a lot of things that a new administration could do in order to deem coal plants as critical infrastructure, certainly thermal generation. There's a lot of things that they could require FERC to do
which
is also responsible for a facet of the reliability of the bulk power system. Certainly as it relates to a lot of incentives and a lot of these subsidies, which totally distort the wholesale electricity markets, there are a lot of things that a new administration and certainly a new Congress could do. I just hope that everybody has a sense of urgency, because we don't have a lot of time as owners of these plants are making decisions about the retirement. You know, when I think about, you know, certainly all these, you know, winter events, you know, whether it was the polar vortex, we like to name them, the bomb cyclone.
Right.
You know, when you look at Winter Storm Elliott, you know, coal provided 39% of the incremental electricity demand in PJM, 39% in MISO, 37% in SPP. When you look at the storm on January the 17th, you know, certainly when the weather was the coldest and peaked, fossil fuels provided 80% of the generation.
Right.
You know, at 5 a.m. and 8 a.m., solar contributed virtually none. Yes, it was windier, but I certainly don't want to depend on my lights continuing to be kept on, having to pray that we have a windier winter if we don't have these fossil fuels.
So let me... I've laid my cards on the table. I think we should keep all of our coal plants open. I think that it right now, especially given what's happening globally, let me ask the question about China first. So step back, and I know you're paid to advocate for coal. I get that, right? Let's be clear. But does it make any sense for the U.S. to be trying to outlaw, or these entities in the U.S. effectively declaring war on coal, when China permitted 2 new coal plants per week last year in 2020, well, I guess it would be 2022, that coal, that China, India, Indonesia in particular are building massive amounts of new coal-fired power. I mean, is this just some kind of hubris in the U.S.? Is there some political play? What, a power play? What, I mean, does it, in the broad sense, if you step back, and I know I'm not asking you to be objective there, you can't, but how does this, what, how meaningful is this in the global sense, the actions, the efforts that are being, the waging of the war on coal in America, how effective is it going to be ultimately in the global scheme of things?
I mean, certainly you only have to look to Europe to see what happens when you lose energy independence. This country has certainly a massive amount of coal and natural gas reserves. When you lose energy security. But I continue to tell my friends and other NGOs that, you know, in this administration, you could retire every coal plant in the United States. It is not going to make a dent in greenhouse gas emissions. China's coal fleet is 1.1 million megawatts. That's almost the size of the entire electricity supply.
Right. In the United States, that's the entire installed generation capacity in the U.S. is about 1.2, 1.3 terawatts. And in and China has about 1.2 terawatts of installed coal capacity by itself, right? I think that's a really important comparison. Yeah.
And China is currently adding 390,000 megawatts. That's twice the size of the existing U.S. coal fleet. But they have determined, if they want affordable, and certainly they have a lot of poverty within their state, and if they want to be an economic driver, that's why they have said, we're going to continue to build coal, natural gas, nuclear.
Right. Yeah. But they're building about 6 times more coal-fired capacity than they are nuclear. So let me ask one, and this isn't a devil's advocate question, but as if I look at the coal sector and I look at it as objectively as I can, and I've been in coal mines, underground mines, above, you know, open cast mines, the ash issue is a problem. I mean, as I look at it, right? And you've had the ash ponds that have burst, we know, and devastated rivers, I think in Tennessee, I think it is. How are you facing, what are the regulations facing coal ash, or they call them coal residuals? Is it coal ash? I forgot what the term of art is. You said there were 6 rules. That one to me seems the one that is, from a physical standpoint, is a difficult one to manage. What are the federal regulations facing coal ash right now? And how does the industry do better on that part of it? Because that, to me, from a physics standpoint, from just a physical world standpoint, is a real problem, or a real challenge rather.
Right. So the two coal ash rules are the effluent limitation guidelines, which I would call liquid ash. And then there is also coal combustion residuals, which is more dry ash and residuals.
Right.
But even during the Trump administration, those rules were certainly revamped, and they were also made more stringent, but certainly more flexible. So coal plant owners, right now, there are 40 who want to comply with the coal combustion residual rule. And they've certainly invested a lot of money to convert these unlined surface impoundments to lined surface impoundments. And so the problem with the changes and the implementation of that rule with this administration is there are 40 coal plants who have basically asked EPA for more time, you know, in order for us to find alternative waste sites, because, again, we still need the power to keep the lights on. And the EPA has been slow to respond back. They denied three of the coal plant owners because it could basically force those 40 plants to either idle within a short amount of time or basically retire. And that's why PJM is also working with the EPA to basically say, you know, hey, we've got to do these over several years, because we can't just take, you know, 40 plants off in a peak summer period when we still obviously need the power from those units. There are a lot of coal plant owners. I don't know if you've talked to many cement manufacturers who are also being impacted by the retirement because they use a lot of coal ash. There's a lot of different products for coal ash that utilities are looking at coal ash more as a commodity. We have a lot of members who certainly are, like everybody else, want to be environmentally responsible, but they've spent a lot of money on coal ash to basically ensure not only that they're complying with the regulations, but they don't have any other environmental harm.
Right. So it's the two coal ash rules, the ozone transport rule, the carbon rule. You said there were six of them. Is that four of the six?
Yeah, there's also the MATS rule. So EPA has recently finalized a more stringent mercury and air toxics rule. And then there's also a regional haze rule, which deals with national parks. And EPA has been slow in implementing that rule, but we certainly expect all six of them to be finalized before probably June of this year.
And that is a way then that the Biden administration can get those rules in place and prevent whatever next administration might be, if it was a Republican or conservative administration, from going back and changing them. Is that what you were saying before?
Yes. So Congress would not be able to use the Congressional Review Act, which would allow them to make changes or basically revise or withdraw those rules.
I see. Okay. And that's 6 months. So it would have to be June. It couldn't be August, because that would be within 6 months of the new Congress coming into power then.
Right.
Okay. Got it. So we've been talking for about an hour, Michelle, and you know, if you've listened to the podcast, I ask guests to introduce themselves. And at the end, I ask what they're reading and what gives them hope. So I know you're busy. You have an enormous number of challenges from your professional job. But when you're reading, when you have time to do reading, what's on your top of your book list?
Top of my book list. You're going to laugh. Like Sydney Sheldon. I read so many engineering technical things. Sometimes it's just nice to read something that's positive and happy and has a happy ending.
And I'm sorry, is Sydney Sheldon? I don't know what that is. Forgive me.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's just a woman writer.
Writes
a lot of romances and
stories. Hey, no judgment. I'm pro reading. I'm, you know, I write books. I'm happy when people read. I'm not gonna make fun of what you're doing. I read a lot. I read technical stuff, but when I'm want to relax, I'm want to relax. So, So final question, Michelle, what gives you hope?
I think what gives me hope, certainly as I've represented the coal industry or the coal fleet for about 6 years, is, you know, it's finally that it's not just America's Power expressing concern. You know, I would say 3-4 years ago, electricity grid operators were not concerned. You know, you didn't really hear them talking about coal retirements or their concern. And now we have electricity experts, whether that's FERC, whether that's Jim Robb, whether that's reliability organizations, state utility commissioners who have been testifying, you know, in these 20 oversight hearings, who have really expressed their concern and the need to ensure that we maintain these dispatchable resources. And we've never seen electricity demand growth like we're seeing it now. And I think people are beginning to realize it's just some of the solutions are very hard and difficult. And we've got to work with a sense of urgency. But we are seeing some of those reforms, state legislation and others being moved forward. We just also need an administration that appreciates the need to put reliability first.
Well, that's a good place to stop. My guest has been Michelle Bloodworth. She's the president and CEO of America's Power. You can find out more about her at americaspower.org. Michelle, it took us a while to get you on the show, but we finally made it happen, and I'm glad we did. I like you, I'm concerned about reliability, and reliability, affordability, resilience are all issues that are front and center for me. So I wish you luck in your job. You have plenty of things on your plate.
Well, you've made a huge difference, and I can't thank you enough. I know you have a huge following. I read your information every day, and I listen to your podcast, and we just need more people like you. So thank you for what you do.
Well, my kids think one of me is enough, so I will leave it there. But thank you. That's very kind. And thanks to all of you out there in podcast land for tuning into this episode of the Power Hungry Podcast. If you have time and are so inclined, give us a positive review, 1, 2, 5, 12 stars, whatever you can do on your local podcast rating thing. And until next time, see ya.